Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, welcome to the show, and we've got an exciting week ahead. This is Real Science Friday week.
Real Science Friday week, or is it Real Science Week?
Real Science Week. We're going to try to pull this off, and to begin with, at the request of one of our listeners, who chipped in some big bucks, Fred, to subsidize this.
And that's great, because I know that the show needs that to happen, to stay on the air.
We really need the support. So for the first show, for Monday, Creation Matters is published by Creation Research Society, and you're their webmaster.
That's right, and we publish this every 2 months, and it's kind of newsletter format. It's a nice newsletter that has it's packed with a lot of articles and really a pretty short publication.
It's really great, and so I'd like us to jump right into the science. And the first article is about a shrimp fossil, but then Fred, the next article is going to be about adult stem cells and stem cells and that whole issue. I'm eager to get to that because you've worked for a company that is in the adult stem cell industry.
Yeah, that's right. I'm looking forward to talking about that.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun. So to start us out, they found a shrimp fossil, and this was published in a creation publication? No, in a scientific evolutionary journal.
Phys.org.
And they said that the fossil is 360 million years old.
Yeah, the title of the article is Oldest Shrimp Looks Shrimpy.
Oldest shrimp.
Looks shrimpy.
Looks shrimpy.
Well, what do they mean?
Yeah, what do they mean? A shrimp has a very, noticeable form. It's so different than us humans. It's just so bizarre looking to us. They're very tasty.
They are very tasty.
They are.
And this, I wonder if this 360-million-year-old guy is as tasty as the ones that we have today, because it looks exactly identical to the ones we chow down on.
You probably could have put this 360-million-year-old shrimp, if it were not fossilized, if somehow it could be reanimated, you could probably put it on a table at a Red Lobster, on a customer's table, along with the other shrimp. And other than the fact that it might be a little bigger because they tend to be chintzy over there with their shrimp sizes, just go to a restaurant where they sell jumbo shrimp. This is identical to a modern shrimp.
Identical. It looks exactly the same. And how many times do we have examples of this, Bob, where there's something in the fossil record that's millions of years old?
Hundreds of millions of years old.
And
hundreds of millions.
Hundreds and hundreds of millions and millions of years old.
Millions and billions. And Fred, they say that human beings evolved from Australopithecus, which is about a 2.5 foot, 3 foot chimp, like Lucy, in just a couple million years, 3 million years. There we go, from chimps to human beings with millions of differences between us. And here a shrimp has stayed identical to a shrimp for a third of a billion years?
Yeah, 360 million years old. It's the same.
It's like the soft tissue T-Rex, and it's like the proteins and fossils and the living bacteria and things that are 100 million years old. It's all evidence that their assumption is false, that the Earth is not millions or billions of years old. These things are recent.
And, these are incredibly complex animals. There's more articles in this newsletter about intelligent design, but do you remember Jonathan Sarfati's article about the mantis shrimp that we covered in Creation Magazine some time ago?
Oh, remind me about that.
Okay.
I've got to interview him recently. He's the world's leading creation author.
Okay, well, I have an interest in this because I have a saltwater aquarium. And it turns out this shrimp is pretty deadly. Most hobbyists don't want one in your tank. So if you hear like this clicking sound at night, you may accidentally have gotten one because they're real hardy. And sometimes you'll buy this what's called live rock from the aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes these things are alive in there. They sharpen their little claws and you hear this clicking in your tank. not only do you hear clicking, about every so often you start missing fish.
Oh, no.
So if you remember, they had an elaborate design like a catapult mechanism that's as powerful as a .22 bullet that hits the fish, kills it, pulls it into its little cave.
I do remember that now.
Yeah.
That's what is it called?
Thumb splitters.
A thumb splitter.
That's one of the things they call it. It's the mantis shrimp.
The mantis shrimp, and it has such a force that it stuns or kills the fish that it wants to eat.
That's right. And it sounds so harmless. Mantis shrimp, you know, like shrimp.
Like a praying
mantis.
But
this thing is, again, most hobbyists don't want it in their tank.
All right. So this is evidence. This is evidence that this shrimp is not 360 million years old. It's only thousands of years old. And along with billions of other living things, was killed in the global flood. And so that all over the world, we have continents covered with 3/4 of a mile or so deep of sedimentary strata and billions of dead things laid down by water, buried in sediments all over the world, just what you'd expect if there were a global catastrophe of a flood, and the mountains have seashells on the mountaintops.
That's right.
All over the world.
And not only that, most of the time they're in a closed position, which means they were buried rapidly, because when a clam dies, it opens.
They didn't just die. Right.
They
were buried catastrophically.
So here we have a shrimp that over 360 million years did not change one iota. It didn't evolve, the poor guy.
Oldest shrimp looks shrimpy. All right. Now, Fred, cells, this is an astonishing feat, this next article here in Creation Matters, published by the Creation Research Society. A Canadian lab has performed an astonishing feat. They have turned human skin cells into blood cells. Skin into blood. And this is extraordinarily important for medical treatment, but also just the science and the sophistication of living organisms.
That's right. And just the elaborate mechanism behind all of this, because there's proteins that control at intricate places, you know, where it splices cells and differentiates them. And they've found the way. It's kind of like turning knobs to turn these human skin cells into blood cells. It's incredibly complex.
Now, that skips a step, doesn't it? Because in the medical industry, we need things like blood cells. And the thought was, well, we could get them from adult stem cells, and adult stem cells avoid the immorality of harvesting children, killing tiny boys and girls, embryos, embryonic stem cell research, of killing those kids to harvest their body parts for scientific exploration. That's immoral. That's taking a child created in God's image and using him for spare parts.
Well, what's been frustrating for me on the whole stem cell debate is these politicians that get on the radio, like Diane DeGette, and brag about the...
And Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, and they brag about the impacts of stem cells, and yet the only success we've had is with adult stem cells. They're not telling the audience that they're talking about adult stem cells.
Yeah, overwhelmingly, when there has been actual clinical trial results, real progress, including, for example, healing people who are blind by taking adult stem cells, putting them on the inside of a contact, and having them wear the contact, and certain kinds of blindness have been cured. These are extraordinary developments, and typically they're with adult stem cells, right?
All the time. So there's not one proven medical benefit yet found for embryonic stem cells. So why this is interesting, maybe more so for me, is because I worked for a large medical company that was developing an adult stem cell chamber to grow adult stem cells.
Okay.
This article here mentions that
it's very difficult.
They're very difficult to produce adult stem cells in quantity. You have to grow them. And I've seen the mechanisms they've used in the past, and it is very expensive and very time-consuming. And so the benefit of this incubation chamber is to grow them rapidly. And the company's pouring, you know, literally tens of millions of dollars into this product because of the benefits of it. If we can...
And there is some hope, right? They're not spending this money foolishly. They expect that they're going to be able to produce rapidly in quantity adult stem cells.
That's right.
To help cure people and save people.
That's right. And we have had positive results in this incubation chamber. You know, basically, I was involved in the engineering behind the pumps and the valves that controlled the the glucose that feeds the cells, and then the lactate, you know, the cell waste products. And there's a device that turns on its axis and kind of rotates, and there's certain things that help stimulate these to grow. But the point is, there's a lot to be gained by producing these adult stem cells in quantity, and now we've got a mechanism where they can convert skin cells into things like blood cells,
right.
And just think of the medical benefits of that.
And so not only does this avoid the ethical dilemma of embryonic stem cells, which there's no dilemma, you just don't do it. You don't kill a child. Even if killing one innocent child could save the whole world, that's the lie of the devil. That's Satan's game. Let's all agree to kill this one child so we could all be better off.
Yeah.
Well, you avoid that with adult stem cells, but now this is avoiding even the need for adult stem cells, literally taking skin cells and turning them into blood cells.
Yep. And I'm speculating here, but I think God in his infinite wisdom made it so that embryonic stem cells would not work.
Well, we actually, Fred, I think we creationists who are also pro-lifers, I think we have an insight into that that the rest of the world is going to take another 10 years to catch up to. And that's the regulatory genes that are so wildly sophisticated. Above and beyond coding for proteins, there are regulatory genes that control how an organism functions. And in human beings, especially, during the embryonic phase, especially, those regulatory genes are going gangbusters.
Mm-hmm.
They're the most extraordinary things and processes that are occurring. And so when you take an embryonic stem cell and you say, okay, we want to turn this into a liver cell, well, there's a whole host of sophisticated, mind-boggling things that we don't even begin to comprehend that are happening, and that's why they typically turn into tumors. It's uncontrollable.
That's right. A lot of people don't know that embryonic stem cells lead to tumors.
Lead to tumors. But, you know, someday, Fred, if they did overcome all those problems and they could solve the world's problems by killing one child, it would be wrong.
It would be completely wrong.
Right.
It's interesting in this article that he says that there's a major advantage to these skin cells converting to blood cells. It says comparing thus far to the disappointing attempts to produce blood cells from human ESCs, and that what that stands for is embryonic stem cells.
Mm. Yeah. So this is real encouraging. And Fred, thanks for your work for a company that had an ethical view of how to help human suffering.
Yeah, and frankly, they're not going to pour millions of dollars into something that hasn't produced results. And, you know, adult stem cells have produced amazing results.
Right, but Democratic U.S. Representative from Denver, Diane DeGette, who you mentioned, she would do that. And Republican Governor of California, former Arnold Schwarzenegger, he would do that. In fact, he had their state spend billions of dollars to fund embryonic stem cell research, not adult stem cell research.
Yeah, that's what's so very frustrating about this. There's a mechanism that works, that's ethical, and yet they're trying to push the money towards the unethical method.
Because they're shaking their fist at God, saying, we can do this. If we want to, you're not going to stop us.
That's right.
So, Fred, how about the Venus flytrap? I'm interested in this article because scientists, Japanese researchers, well, they're busy over there in Japan. They figure a lot of things out. They've been studying the Venus flytrap, and that thing snaps shut in less than a second to catch its insect prey. And so this amazes me. We like to think about, how does a caterpillar evolve? How could a caterpillar put itself into this cocoon, this chrysalis, and then liquefy itself and then come out a different creature? It's just too much.
It's so mind-boggling. And now here you've got this Venus flytrap that has basically the intelligent design within it to have this snapping mechanism within half a second. So I try to imagine the evolutionist story behind this. How do they explain that?
Yeah. First of all, the plant has to be able to digest insects. So that's one of the steps. That's new.
Yep.
That's more like an animal digesting an insect for lunch. So the plant has to be able to digest insects, but then it has to be able to procure those insects. And so the way the Venus flytrap, the way it can snap shut in less than a second is have you ever seen a contact lens when you could fold it inside out and it'll flip from concave to convex?
Yeah.
Just it'll hop like off the tabletop. Well, that's a design from the physics of it. When you go from the one shape to the other, there's a lot of stored energy that's then released, kinetic energy. And so the Venus flytrap is designed in that way so that it's like muscles in a plant. It's just extraordinary.
So the evidence for the ancestor for the Venus flytrap in the fossil record would be a lot of starved Venus flytraps because they didn't do it quick enough. And maybe insects were really slow at one time in the past, and so the Venus flytrap could shut it. Maybe.
A lot of very hungry Venus flytraps. And Fred, what's
right alongside the giraffes with the exploded heads.
Yeah, that's right. So these Japanese researchers have figured out that there are two chemicals that get stored up similar to the way we have neurotransmitters that send signals from one cell to another cell and they'll trigger our muscles to flex. Well, that's what's going on in a Venus flytrap. And so when you think about all the chemical compounds in the world and the need to zero in on two out of quadrillions, and you need to zero in on two, and then they need to trigger this mechanism, and they need to distinguish between when is this an insect and when is it debris, and they do that very well.
Yeah.
And the plant doesn't have a brain.
That's right. How does it tell the difference? Like when we play with those things and put our fingers in them.
Yeah. It's just so awesome. So God is an awesome designer, and I think we'll see more examples in this show today of how design in nature, even the atheists and evolutionists, are beginning to use the terminology to recognize they're searching for the purpose of the design in nature.
That's right. And there's an article in here about the purpose-driven science that ignores Darwin. So it's kind of like this silent de facto intelligent design behind the scenes.
Yeah, because if you say you believe in intelligent design, you could be fired.
You could be fired or lose funding, right. All kinds of bad things.
And so, in fact, why don't we look at that article right now? Because it's like a hidden intelligent design movement where there are scientists and authors and editors who they can't say intelligent design. But here's an example out of the same publication, this journal, PhysOrg, and they have an article, and here's the title of their article, and this comes from Japan also, an advanced science institute in Japan, RIKEN. The article is titled, Searching for Purpose in Proteins. Now, a protein, what's a protein?
Well, a protein is a bunch of, if you want to get technical, is a bunch of amino acids that forms into a specific shape, and a protein has a specific function within the cell, right?
All right, so it's a bunch of amino acids, and they're all lined up in a certain order, and then they're folded in a certain way.
They have to be folded in a certain shape, and if they're not, they're discarded and thrown out. Whole folding process is remarkably complex.
Yeah, just to get the amino acids in the right order, if it happened by random chance, it could take billions of years to get one. But then you got to fold them. Then you got to fold them. And even if you did all that, then you happen to have, by accident, a protein. But what's the good of it unless it is controlled?
Yeah, and if it folds, regulated. It's got to fold just right. It's kind of like those transformers our kids have now, right?
Yeah.
If you fold them in the right way, they turn into some transformer guy.
And there's a right way to do it and a wrong way. And like my brother Brian Enyar, he does homes, remodeling, doors, windows. He's an expert window and door guy. And he says, like with a lock, when you put in a sophisticated lock on a front door, there's 10,000 wrong ways to do it, literally. There's one right way to do it. So if you're just going to try to guess at how to do it, you're going to be there for a long time. You need to either read the directions, the instructions, or you need to know how to do it.
Well, part of the problem with me is knowing how to read the directions. I mean, I can read them, but sometimes they're so confusing. I do one of those hundreds out of 10,000 wrong ways of doing it.
So, Fred Williams, just imagine that you are the blind forces of nature and you're trying to assemble a sophisticated protein that's way more complex than the most complex front door lock assembly. And it's got to happen by chance, get all the right parts. by chance in order, and then they all have to be folded like you're folding some, like you said, a sophisticated transformer device. Yep.
Well, my wife would say that I am kind of like a blind force when I'm working on things around the house.
All right, so sort of similar. So, Fred, when they say this article title in an evolutionary journal, they're searching for purpose in proteins, they're belying something. They recognize that these proteins that are enigmas to them, they're mysterious. Like, what do they do? They believe they do something.
Yeah.
Well,
why? Past experience.
Yeah. So, but why? If we're just evolving and if there's all this junk in our DNA, why would these proteins have a function?
Yeah, evolution would predict all kinds of functionless items in the genome, right?
Right,
in the DNA.
Sure. So they're searching for purpose in proteins. And purpose is a term for intelligent design. Purpose means you have a person.
That's
so,
right.
Fred, there are other examples in here. For example, imitating insects. When you have Harvard and Penn State University in the Naval Research Lab, and they are doing what's called biomimetics, they're engineering a thin film from water striders. We talked about these insects recently. They walk on the surface of water, and they're engineering film based on the butterfly wings, how they shed water. And so this is a very subtle way for them to acknowledge the brilliance of the designer.
That's right. Basically, what they're doing is what we call reverse engineering something. If when you reverse engineer something, you're implying that there is an engineer behind it.
Yeah. And the same thing with researchers in Australia who are trying to figure out why do ostriches run so well compared to humans. If we resize for, you know, our size and weight and all, ostriches run just in this most extraordinary manner with efficiency. And they figured out that their elastic tendons store so much energy that it's as though they're running on pogo sticks.
Unbelievable.
This is in the BBC News, and that's really fun. So then the one that just I love because it goes to a creation icon is the next one about the bombardier beetle.
That's right. And now you got scientists who wanted to develop a sprayer based on their study of the bombardier beetle.
They wanted to spray liquids of all kinds. You know how you have spray cans in your home, and liberals get mad at spray cans, aerosol sprays, if they have CFCs in them, chlorofluorocarbons.
Chlorofluorocarbons?
Yeah. Yeah, they get mad at CFCs, so can't have CFCs.
And they cause what? Is it the ion holes in the
ozone?
Ozone, and probably now global warming, right?
The acid rain was going to destroy us. We don't talk about that anymore. There was a global cooling in the 70s.
Yep.
We don't talk about that global ice age anymore. And it was the ozone hole, and I think the CFCs were to prevent an ozone hole from expanding.
And I bet you now they cause global warming.
I bet you they do. So anyway, not the sun. The sun doesn't cause global warming, just the CFCs probably. Okay, so Fred, in Leeds University in Britain, they have won an award, a design team there, for developing a brand new environmentally friendly sprayer. And it's apparently a pretty good sprayer. How far? Do you see how far?
Yeah, up to 4 meters, which is what, about 13 feet.
13 feet, the spray nozzle, and they modeled it after the bombardier beetle. And why do creationists love to talk about the bombardier beetle?
Well, because the bombardier beetle has a very unique mechanism of defending itself. It has two chambers in its body of two different kinds of chemicals that if they mix together, then the thing, it basically explodes.
It explodes.
And so they discharge these chemicals from their body, from their behind, and at a certain angle behind them, these chemicals meet and they explode, but it's far enough behind the beetle to prevent him from exploding.
And they shoot these things. They have good aim. It's like a turret from an airplane.
That's right.
From like a very accurate World War II airplane. It's a rotating turret. And so they shoot these and they add an anti-inhibitor, and these two liquids explode in about 212 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. And it's very effective. Well, if this is evolving, right, you're going to evolve all this. First of all, these two chemicals, they're going to blow up and kill the thing every time it starts to think, oh, you know, if only I could make an explosion.
That's right. So how do you explain this thing evolving over time? I kind of picture this general with a one-star general. They're peering through that hole to watch the big explosions.
Right.
And they bring out the next bombardier beetle to see if he'll evolve correctly. And, well, those two chambers are still a little bit too close to each other, and the thing explodes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and you got to evolve the mechanism for shooting these two fluids that mix together, and it's just...
All this stuff has to be in place from the beginning. There's no way that that can happen by chance.
So, well-known design scientist who works at the University of Leeds in Britain, and Andy McIntosh.
And, you know, a lot of us guys are going to love this thing. If we can have a sprayer that sprays 13 feet, and especially like if we got a wasp nest in our...
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm always looking for those real far sprayers because, you know...
Yeah, exactly. I've been stung enough times in my life. And so here's what scientist Andy McIntosh said. He said nobody had studied the beetle from a physics and engineering perspective as we did, and we didn't appreciate how much we would learn from it. In other words, evolution has been stunting scientific progress because scientists are not thinking in terms of, well, these creatures were engineered for these functions. So when we look at how they perform those functions, we will likely gain great engineering insight.
That's right. If you take the evolutionary point of view, you're going to be thinking in terms of mistakes over, you know, eons of time.
Into a creature that happens to be able to survive. And instead, the reality is each organism has a brilliant designer, our God who created us. And you could read about him in the Bible from Genesis through to Revelation. Especially, I like the Gospel of John because it explains Christ's role in the creation and in our salvation through his death and resurrection.
And how did the Bible define faith?
Faith is the evidence of things not seen.
That's right.
The evidence. So there's overwhelming evidence that God has created us. So thank you, Fred Williams, so much for joining us today.
Hey, it's great to be back, and it sounds like I'll be right back here tomorrow.
Yeah, Real Science Friday week right here on KGov, on Bob Inyart Live. And our telethon has been going well. Now, Fred, I could let you know what's happening. We had a goal in our last telethon of 100 people who would pledge $20 a month, or more, of course. And if they were already pledging $20, if they increased it, some people can do that, many people cannot, but if they increased it to 40, that would count as another pledge. And so the goal was 100, and we got 70 people, which was such a thrill and a help. And so now we're continuing that, and we're up to 75 people who have pledged $20 a month. And so if someone else could call 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278, make a $20 a month pledge, or that can happen online at KGov, KGOV.com. And also, we're hoping, we're praying that we'd be able to raise $20,000 in one-time gifts right now. Fred, you see the way we operate here at Bob Inyart Live. We're on a shoestring budget.
That's right. And, you know, this airtime doesn't come for free.
No.
And I know it isn't your favorite topic, but it is important that people realize that to stay on the air, we have to have your help.
It's important. And, Fred, you're humble and gracious, but I'd like to tell the audience you've helped Bob Inyart Live tremendously over the many, many years financially. So thank you for what you and your family have done. And everybody involved, either volunteers or supporters, and we need your help if you can at all help. Thank you, Fred.
Thank you, Bob.
God bless you. KGov, KGOV.com.